Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
You're listening to HR Power Hour presented by CMA, Career.com, and Verrill. I'm Tani Alvarez, a partner in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group, and today our guest is Paul Karelis, Vice President of the HR Services at MassPay Solutions. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Tani. Glad to be here.
So one of the things that I really want to talk to you about today, and I think is important for our listeners, is how to prepare for a wage and hour audit.
Sure.
And I say how to prepare, but with hope, you're going to do your own self-audit before the Department of Labor ever comes knocking on your door.
Yeah, that's never a fun visit.
It's not. And I think that if they do come knocking, you're going to have a couple of phone calls you're going to want to make either to professionals on your team, whether it's an outside service provider or an attorney, so that they can walk you through some very specific rules and steps that you're going to want to take with regards to your interactions with the Department of Labor itself. The first rule is do not slam the door in their face.
That's a good one.
And the next one is no, we do not bake them fresh cookies and ask them to stay all week. But we do want to be somewhere in between those two. With hope, however, before they even get here, you've done your own HR audit, and that's what I want to talk to you about.
Sounds good.
First, though, I think it's always super important for our listeners to understand why I chose you to talk about this. So can you give our listeners a little bit of information about your background and what you do at MassPay Solutions?
Sure, yeah. So my interest in HR started decades ago when I was working in retail and just saw the HR function in action and just kind of interested me, saw how it helped people, helped the business, helped a business run smoothly. So I was fortunate enough that my employer at the time, a local grocery chain, took me under their wings and showed me the ropes of HR. And from there, I just kind of grew within the HR roles, eventually getting into HR outsourcing and HR consulting. So that's kind of what we did at MassPay. I've been there for 5 or 6 years now, and I came aboard to start the HR services division, where we help businesses of all sizes, from small under 10 employees all the way up to a couple thousand employees, help them strategically with their HR function, whether it be wage and hour, preparing for audits, handbook, compliance, all that kind of fun stuff, and employee communications as well. So it's really full spectrum strategic HR consulting, and it's really what I love to do.
And that is something that MassPay offers to its client base, correct? So
yes.
It's not just payroll or human capital management software itself, but MassPay solution clients also have the ability or access to individuals who are in a role such as yours.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So with our HR services offering, you are assigned a specific certified HR professional who works as your kind of HR generalist or HR consultant. You develop a relationship with them. They get to know your business, kind of what your culture is like, what your mission is, what your goals for the business are, short-term and long-term, whether or not they're related to the HR function, and kind of build out a game plan from there. And it always starts with a HR assessment or an HR audit. So, again, a very important function of the process, and then we kind of build out an action plan from there.
I think what you've just mentioned is super important and something that we maybe don't talk enough about. And that's the fact that while you and I are going to sit here, we're going to talk for a while about an HR audit, we're talking in generalities.
Right.
Every employer has different needs, desires, and operational goals, which means that there are going to be differences between a HR audit or a wage and hour audit that occurs for one entity versus another. Correct?
For sure, yeah. I mean, and at the end of the day, sometimes you have to talk about comfort with risk and exposure. And, you know, some companies are more willing to do things and the way they want to do them and understand, you know, so much of it is just about understanding risk and what the potential outcomes might be should there be a DOL audit. And more often than not, in my experience, I've found that a good faith effort goes a long way. So a lot of times we'll be working with a business that's been around for a while. We certainly work with startups, but a lot of times we'll be entering a situation with a business where they've been around for a couple years, sometimes a couple decades, and through that process, we do uncover some things that aren't quite right. So it's just a matter of taking it from there and showing that you're making a good faith effort to correct the things. Let's say your I-9s are all out of sorts. We get them in where they need to be and then make a memo to record to say, yes, we discovered some things on this date. And as of X date, they are all now correct and should be going forward. And we found we've had several I-9 audits, especially over the last couple of years. And when we've gone and taken those extra steps and shown a good faith effort, it's gone a long way in reducing or eliminating fines and penalties.
I think that's a really good point. And interestingly enough, I was dealing with the Department of Labor investigator last week, and the day before the closing conference, she sent out 30 different attachments, 30 different informational sheets, to which I scanned through, and my heart was definitely beating much faster because I was like, I did not see issues in all of these areas. I mean, I had employing minors in non-agricultural positions, and I'm thinking back to myself saying this client doesn't employ minors, and I'm going through all these thoughts in my head. What it comes down to is there weren't issues, right? They just wanted to make sure that we were aware of the library of resources that the Department of Labor had available. But they are there to help and to guide. And honestly, in most cases, I would much rather a client experience a Department of Labor audit than I would for them to experience a wage and hour lawsuit. Because from a lawsuit standpoint, and you know this, and I'm sure it's something that you discuss with your clients all the time, you're looking at, in most cases, a 3 to a 6 year look back. You're looking at treble damages. You're looking at attorney's fees for the other side. You're looking at attorney's fees to defend the claim. And in most cases, you're not looking at a single individual suing you. You're looking at a class action. And very quickly and very easily are you reaching, you know, $250,000, $500,000, over $1 million of exposure. And I think those are important things for people to recognize when we're talking about something like this. Is it may seem dull and boring, especially if you're the type of person who is really interested in human connections and more of the emotional side to human resources, but understanding that the quote-unquote paperwork or the pushing around or entering data is so, so very important from a risk standpoint.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great point, and it is very scary. And to add to that, I think also when you're in the position of an audit, it's much easier to frame things in a good faith effort, whereas once things enter litigation, it's very easy for things to get spun around and appear more malicious than they may really be.
Absolutely. So let's get into it. I mean, we've now spent a bunch of time talking about why it's important, but let's talk about we sit down with someone and we say, let's do an audit. Let's talk about the first thing. Let's talk about payment of wages and minimum wage and overtime. What are some elements or things that we're going to want to be considering when we are looking at this function?
Well, especially if you're a multi-state employer, that's one of the biggest challenges out there. And that's where, you know, we really work hard with a lot of businesses that do have multi-state presence, because as much as the federal government may be moving to deregulate in many ways on the business side, many states either already have in place or are working to enact kind of counter legislation that makes things a lot more complicated. So really, nowadays, nearly every state has its own set of wage and hour rules, whether it be their own minimum wage, sometimes their own exemption rules, things like that. So first, we have to know kind of where the work is being performed, what states are the employees in, and really take a look at job descriptions is always a good place to start, too, to see. If you're seeing a lot of payroll records where people are just being paid salary, you want to scrutinize that because there can be some exposure there.
Let's divide this into two different elements because I think we've touched on two things so far. One thing that I often get from a client when they want an answer that I can't give them is, but we are incorporated in Delaware. So isn't it Delaware law? Isn't my incorporation what's most important? I'm going to let you give the answer that I always give. So I'm incorporated in Delaware. Isn't that the only law that matters?
Unfortunately, no. We really need to take a look at where the work is being performed.
And it's not the headquarter or the location where that employee has been set to work. It's where that employee is physically located, correct?
Exactly. So another big challenge right now is in this day and age and where technology has gotten to where it is. You have so many telecommuters and people working from home offices. They can be several states away, a state you have no familiarity with whatsoever. You can be in New Hampshire and have an employee out in California, and all of a sudden you're going to get a really quick education on how hairy the laws in some of those states can be.
Yeah, so you're a New Hampshire company. You've got an employee who, let's say they're just going out there for a year. They're going to telecommute from San Francisco for 1 year, right? You've got new reporting requirements. You've got new paid time off requirements. You've got a new minimum wage requirement.
Exactly.
Another place in which I see people get a little hung up from the minimum wage standpoint, and this is going to sound going to sound silly because I think a lot of people say, like, if we can't get minimum wage right, what's happening? But the problem is especially if you have multiple locations and you're in restaurant or hospitality, right? So in hospitality, you keep thinking to yourself, well, I'm using the tipped minimum wage. I'm using the tip credit. So we're fine because there's still, I have employees who are making, you know, $30 an hour, $15 an hour. But the problem is they're tipped minimum wage. They haven't been moving up as the minimum wage has been increasing, correct?
Correct.
So I think, and this sounds very industry specific, but if you are using a tip credit, keeping on top of those things is really important. And I know in a number of audits that I've found that that's where we've had problems generally.
Yeah, for sure. And with those hospitality and restaurant groups, some things that we see quite often are if it's a multi-location, they have a worker who works in multiple locations and they're kind of counting those hours separately and not thinking that when those hours combined exceed 40, that's an overtime situation. So we've seen some companies get hit on that.
That must become a really interesting question, too, as well, with regards to how they are processing their payroll. Kind of if they have multiple entities that are integrated into one system, do they have a centralized HR function, or is everything doing things differently? And if so, then do you have HR managers at each location that are communicating with each other if they have common ownership?
Right, yeah. Communication is key, as with many things.
So you mentioned as well kind of concerns if everyone is salary, and I want to talk about that a little bit later.
Sure.
But let's talk about overtime. So we talked about your payment of minimum wage, making sure that people are being paid minimum wage. What should we be considering when we're looking at overtime payment?
Well, the real challenge with overtime that a lot of people don't realize, and we see it a lot, is figuring out what the regular rate really is. So regular rate is a legal term, and it's basically what you need to factor in when you're figuring out what should time and a half be based on, what should the overtime rate be based on. And what employers often don't realize is things like commissions, non-discretionary bonuses, other things like that do have to be factored in when you're figuring out what the regular rate of pay is and what the overtime calculation should be. So we see countless employers get hit on that. There is some proposed rules out there from the Department of Labor that may clarify some of the regular rate definition a little bit in terms of perks and wellness plans and things like that. But there's a lot to consider when you are paying overtime.
That's something important, too, when we're looking at handbooks. And we're not going to talk about handbook reviews during this episode. But make sure if you have like a to-do list right now, something to look at next time you're in the office, check to see if your handbook says that overtime is going to be paid at time and a half of your hourly rate. Because if that's what it says, that's technically incorrect. It needs to say your regular rate of pay, which granted is a legal definition, but it's an important legal definition.
For sure.
You are listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, and we've been talking to Paul Corellis, Vice President of HR Services at MassPay Solutions. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
It's 3 p.m., and you just ran out of ink. You have a report due end of day, which is 2 hours from now. You can't push the deadline because end of day means end of today, not end of tomorrow day. What now? Go to your local Staples store. Staples now has an even bigger selection of HP ink and toner. In store, in stock, and at low prices every day. So you can get your ink fast for less. End of story.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
You're listening to HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Paul Corellis, Vice President of HR Services at MassPay Solutions. And we've been discussing the ins and outs and best practices with regards to wage and hour audits. So earlier in the segment, Paul and I spent a decent amount of time talking about minimum wage and overtime. And I'm sure you're thinking, how much time can one really spend talking about those very basic things? But as Paul laughs, he's laughing because he knows that if you don't have the foundations in place, that's when you get in the most trouble.
For sure.
Let's talk about other foundational elements. And I cut you off in the last segment when you started talking about having 100% of your workforce as salary exempt. Tell me, Paul, why that potentially is going to be a problem. But actually, I'm going to even back it up one more step. Isn't salary and exempt the same thing? Am I just like lawyer talking and giving more words than are necessary?
Unfortunately, no. So I can't tell you how many times we start working with a business and kind of get to those questions. How do you calculate overtime? How are the employees compensated? What have you? And they kind of brush it off and think we're going to move on to the next subject because they just say, oh, we just pay everyone's salary. We don't need to worry about that. Next question. So unfortunately, no, salary and exempt are very different. When we're talking exempt, what we're really referring to is exempt from portions of the FLSA or Fair Labor Standards Act, which kind of is the federal law which dictates minimum wage and overtime and all that fun stuff that we're talking about today. So in order for someone to be truly exempt, there are a few things. First, in most cases, with a couple of exceptions, they need to be paid on a salary basis. That salary has to be at a certain level, and that's kind of in flux as we speak. And then also we need to take a look at their essential job duties and primary job duties to determine if the work that they're doing on a regular basis does in fact meet the requirements of someone that should be paid at an exempt salaried level and exempt from overtime.
So two things that we're going to really be looking at. One of them is going to be called the salary basis test, right? Do they meet the salary threshold? And then the other aspect of it is the job duties requirement, correct?
Correct.
And in addition to that, because, you know, as a lawyer, I always love to just throw in that wrench. We're not just looking at the Fair Labor Standards Act in most cases, correct?
That's very true. So as I mentioned earlier, as the federal government has moved one way, states have moved another. So depending where you have employees, sometimes state by state, sometimes county by county, you can have different salary thresholds or even different exemptions. So California, for instance, has an inside sales exemption that doesn't really exist in other states or even at the federal level. So depending where these employees are working, we really need to scrutinize based on that location.
And earlier, one of the things that we discussed was the difference in advice or counsel that we give when we are going in and auditing or talking to a client regarding best practices regarding wage and hour, and the understanding that while certain exemptions may exist under federal law, if they don't exist under state law and an employer wants to use that exemption, understanding how much risk they are running for a state audit or for a federal audit versus a state lawsuit or a federal lawsuit. Recognizing, again, as we've already discussed, kind of the difference in what the exposure is from a administrative audit standpoint versus a lawsuit.
For sure. And another thing we've seen sometimes is when there are differences between state wage and hour law and federal wage and hour law, and there is an audit in place, sometimes the auditor will see something and it will be in compliance with their jurisdiction. But if they happen to know that that is out of compliance with state or federal, whichever the other party is, you know, they feel that they're a mandatory reporter, and then all of a sudden you have a secondary audit from that other jurisdiction questioning because they did hear that there was potentially some compliance issues.
So I'd love to focus on three primary forms of the duty test, and I'm going to just focus on three, even though there are a ton, and we know there's a ton, both because states have different rules and requirements. I mean, we have one for collection of seaweed here in Maine, right? So those type of things. So there are a multitude of very specific, industry-specific exemptions, and I have to always laugh at which lobbying groups did the best job, yeah, either at state or federal level, to get some of these exemptions. But the three I'd love to talk about is the executive exemption, the administrative exemption, and the professional exemption. And I think it makes sense to start with the easiest and then go down to the hardest.
Okay.
So the professional exemption. Can you tell me a little bit about what that exemption is? And I don't need the exact rule of law, of course, because you can go on to the Federal Department of Labor website and they have these amazing fact sheets, right? But let's talk generally about what a professional exemption is going to be.
Sure. So that's usually in a very specific field. And generally speaking, what they look at is the person who's performing that function or in that role has a very specialized certification or degree that's, again, very specific to the job that they're doing. So while they may have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, if it's in general studies rather than what the specific job is that they're doing and related to that, you can sometimes run into trouble. Also, things like work study and things where it's more of an apprenticeship type situation, those oftentimes will fail to meet that professional exemption.
So the interns, the trainees, and the volunteers, I mean, what's a difference between a volunteer and an intern, I guess, first?
Yeah, well, you certainly run into trouble anytime you're a for-profit business and try to have free labor. That's always generally a no-no. The interns are really, and again, state by state, this has varied a lot. There's been a lot of litigation, as I'm sure you've seen, with interns and unpaid interns especially. But I guess that the bottom line is the more closely you can be working directly with the educational institution and have a formalized program, that tends to offer some protections versus just kind of hiring interns off the street and expecting them to work without pay. That can obviously oftentimes be troublesome.
I 100% agree, and specifically that work with pay or work without pay is where the initial issues start kind of generally, or if it's stipend work, if it's I expect you to work 80 hours a week and I'm going to pay you $300 because of the quote-unquote value of my experience, that by putting me on your resume, the sky's the limit as a result of this amazing opportunity I'm providing you with, without understanding that, well, in order to have an intern or to bring in someone like that, it's going to cost you time, energy, money, if you're not going to pay them the minimum wage. So that's kind of the professional exemption. And we still have the duties test. So the duties that you're a doctor, a lawyer, you have this advanced degree kind of generally, and it's not just limited to those few professions. There's very specific ones that are set forth, as well as the fact that they meet a threshold salary requirement. Now let's talk about the executive exemption. Does that only apply to the highest person in your organization? Do you have to have executive or CEO or COO in your job title in order to get that exemption?
Nope, not necessarily. What you do generally have to have is some sort of management position where you do kind of have the power to hire, fire, or at least have a lot of influence over the hiring or firing decisions for at least, I believe it's 2 full-time equivalent employees. And I have seen in audits with clients in the past where they do actually add up the hours of the people that they're overseeing and managing. And if it falls short of that kind of 80-hour requirement, that they have been found to not meet the executive exemption. So you really have to watch. If they just supervise or manage one person, then they're likely going to fall short of that. But if they do have multiple part-time employees or 2 full-time employees, they will generally meet the exemption there as long as they have quite a bit of say in those people's employment.
My rule is always 2 heartbeats. I need 2 individual hearts that are beating and at least 80 hours of work. So it could be 4 hearts performing 80 hours, but it can't be 1 heart performing 80 hours.
That's a good rule of thumb.
So there's that element to it. And then the other element to that is this is a weekly look back. And sometimes I think that it's hard for people to recognize this because in a restructure, in a reorganization, or let's just say one of your employees quits, right? So you have a manager who oversees 2 individuals, both full time. So normally you'd have 2 beating hearts, 80 hours a week, but one of them quits. In that week or 2 weeks or the month in which it takes you to fill that position, that manager is not appropriately exempt under the executive exemption unless we can fit them into a different exemption for that period of time.
Yeah, that's a great point. Another area where I've seen this be troublesome is either geographically or industry specific, where there are seasonal fluctuations. So there might be, as you said, a week or 2 weeks where the business really dies down, or they only need one person or have a skeleton crew because of seasonal fluctuations. And as you said, that really does jeopardize the exemption during that time period.
Let's talk about what I find to be the most difficult exemption, and that's the administrative exemption. And I say it's the most difficult in large part because I feel as though it's a catch-all.
Yes.
And most employers say, I want this person to be salary exempt because of the concept of putting them on salary and not punching that clock. So I'm going to use the administrative exemption. Let's talk about what we need in order to have the administrative exemption.
Sure. So they have to be working towards the general operations of the business and have influence or decision-making control or discretion on what's called matters of significance for the business. And that's really tough to define. So And one rule of thumb is you really can't go by the job title because you can have something like, say, an office manager role where, depending on what their duties are, they could fall on either side of that exemption. If they're just doing inventory for administrative supplies and doing the order at the office supply store, then that's really not a matter of significance. But if they're signing contracts or entering into agreements on behalf of the company, like some office managers do, then you have a stronger case towards meeting that exemption.
Sometimes we'll see this as well with, and I find it specifically in a marketing department or some other type of kind of outward promotional space, whether or not you're kind of the director of social media or something like that, where you have this title that seems as though like significant discretion and control, but really it's just the person who makes sure that the post goes up or that the pictures match the post. And based off of the title, they want it to be a salary exempt position, but not understanding kind of discretion and control over matters of significance. And when I really dig down or when we ask those questions, it becomes clear pretty fast that this person isn't posting or making decisions or signing contracts without it going through either one or a multitude of individuals before any activity occurs.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of questions that I'll ask when we're kind of scrutinizing these with clients is, how much direction are you giving them in terms of what they're doing, and how much approval do they need to receive before they do some of these things? So those are a couple of red flags if they're receiving a lot of direction or they're having to get approval for anything, you know, considered important.
Another element of it that I think often kind of gets people a little bit confused or turned around is that it should be outside of the general operations of the creation of whatever the service or product is. Mm. And the example I often like to use, and you might have another one that is helpful, is if you're a widget manufacturer, right? This person who's an administrative exempt person is not 100% necessary for a widget to get made. It might be necessary for this person to get paid for that widget, to get the supplies for that widget, to market that widget, to cost account for that widget, but they are not touching the widget in order to be administratively exempt in most cases.
That's a great point. A lot of people don't take that into consideration.
So those would be our three most common, I think, exemptions: the administrative, the executive, and the professional. So, Paul,
yes,
we'll do a question before we take our next break. Where does the independent contractor fall into those three exemptions?
Oh, boy, that is a trick question. So. Most likely not any of those. And again, another opportunity where we kind of take a look at state-by-state coverage.
So we're going to take a quick break, and we are going to return, and we're going to talk a little bit more about independent contractors with Paul Corrales, the Vice President of HR Services at MassPay Solutions. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. JobsInME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
You're listening to HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Beryl. This is Tawny Alvarez, and our guest today is Paul Corrales, Vice President of HR Services at MassPay Solutions. Today, we've been talking about wage and hour audits generally, ones that can be performed in-house before the Department of Labor comes in and does their big scary audit. I'm just joking. It shouldn't be big and scary. Or before you experience a wage and hour lawsuit, which I promise you is the last thing that you want to experience. It does mean that you get to talk to me or any other favorite HR attorney that you have, but it is not going to be your most exciting experience.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the break, we were talking about exempt and non-exempt employees, and specifically kind of administrative, professional, and executive exempt employees. And I threw Paul a curveball, and I want to talk more about it. And what I asked him was, where do independent contractors fall within this segment? And he appropriately answered, hopefully, not within any one of them. And why? Why is that the case, Paul?
More and more, independent contractor designation and classification is just a real trap. So the federal government has their own standards for what can be considered an independent contractor versus an employee. But more and more what we're seeing are states respond and respond dramatically as they're realizing that a lot of businesses have taken advantage of it and just added workers as independent contractors without the same rights and responsibilities that employees would have in an employee-employer relationship.
We're seeing more and more legislation, too, kind of generally, that's even pushing it back further. So in a multitude of states in New England, within the last, I'd say, 5 years, we've seen a change or an update as to what the status is, making it more and more difficult to label someone as an independent contractor. This is interesting in a time in which Uber and Lyft and a number of other service providers who rely on independent contractors really are changing the way that we experience a multitude of past services or kind of interactions with the public, whether or not it's for transportation or for other general needs. If you have a tax professional who's telling you, yes, it's an independent contractor, that's correct, is that the only thing you should be looking at, or are there a multitude of other factors we should be taking into account?
Yeah, in this day and age, you really need to scrutinize it. So this is a real conflict between technology, entrepreneurship, and labor laws and legislation, as you said. So we've seen many times where a tax professional or an accountant has given good advice based on their knowledge and what kind of their area of expertise is in, but you really need to be talking to an HR professional or sometimes even legal counsel if there's any question whatsoever about the validity of anyone that you're paying with a 1099.
And this is also something to go back on something that, Paul, you said earlier, state by state.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have somebody in Alabama who's providing services who may effectively be an appropriately classified independent contractor under federal law and any Alabama state law that may exist. But in California, I would guess it would be quite different.
For sure. So we're seeing it even in litigation, as I'm sure you have, where states are suing the Ubers of the world, and the results are sometimes different depending on where the case is being heard. So it's definitely, again, adds to the confusion for multi-state employers in terms of you can't really have one uniform way of doing things in most cases. You really have to take into consideration where is the work being performed.
Oftentimes clients will say, and I'm sure you've heard it as well, they're independent contractors because that's what they want. That's how they prefer it. They don't want to be an employee. They refuse to be an employee. And if we tried to make them an employee, they wouldn't provide services for us. My response to that is always, as long as you recognize the risk, is this person important enough to your organization that you're ready to deal with the fines for failure to pay the taxes, failure to pay unemployment, and if this individual experiences a workplace injury and they do not have their own appropriate workers' compensation coverage, do you know whether or not your structure or your workers' compensation insurance is going to provide coverage? In most cases, it won't. And then are you ready to deal with the ramifications of something like that?
Definitely. Yeah, the liability is definitely on the side of the employer. And then further complicating things, we're seeing states, you know, even set more traps, so to speak. So down in Massachusetts, they have a new paid family medical leave law about to take effect. And basically the way that they wrote that is that if you, more than half of your workforce is made up of independent contractors, you kind of have to consider those as employees and cover them in terms of the PFML tax. So even if they are legitimately independent contractors, there are additional responsibilities that you do have. And I imagine those are going to be more scrutinized when they see the returns coming in with so many independent contractors on an employer's rolls.
So individual responsibility, I think that that's something that you've mentioned a couple times, and I want to dig down a little bit deeper into it. And I want to talk about something that seems so, so easy, and yet oftentimes it's those fundamental things that aren't occurring. And one of the requirements that I'm talking about are posting requirements, are the requirements that are set forth under state or federal or even in some cases local law that require certain information to be posted. How important is that?
It's very important. I mean, certainly I've seen it numerous times when there is an on-site audit from a member of the Department of Labor. They are checking workplaces, or sometimes they're going in and speaking to employees and asking, do you know where the workplace posters are? Have you seen the postings? And it's very important. And again, not an area to overlook your remote employees and your telecommuting employees. There are a number of options nowadays where either through an intranet or electronically or sending them physical postings, you still have those obligations, even if the employees are not working at one of your main work sites.
I think that's something that I hear more and more often as well, is I've never met this person. Well, that doesn't matter, because you still do have those posting obligations. And granted, many of these laws were effectuated or came into existence well before there was any realization that our workforce would look like it does today. But that doesn't change the fact that you need to creatively figure out how you're going to accomplish the requirements that are set forth in many of these state and federal posting.
Yeah, and another trend we're starting to see is a additional requirement that you're able to prove that receipt of those notices. So again, check with the states you're doing work in. Is an electronic signature acceptable? If so, what are the guidelines? What are the requirements for an electronic signature if you're sending it electronically, or do you need to have them physically sign a sheet of paper?
In addition to posting requirements, I mean, you've just touched on it and kind of moved us in that direction, record keeping.
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter where I keep everything, how I keep it, as long as it's somewhere? I mean, if the Department of Labor wants to come and audit me, good, they can dig through the 12 dozen boxes I have in the other room. Is that in my best interest?
It really isn't. It kind of, as I spoke to the kind of mandatory reporter obligations, you certainly want to respond fully and cooperate with any investigation or any audit. That being said, you don't want to share more than you necessarily need to or have to, so you want to keep things organized well in terms of a confidential file, a general employee file. We always recommend keeping your I-9 separate, so if those are getting rifled through, they're only going through the I-9s and not any other unnecessary documents. So, organization is going to be key. If you are doing electronic storage, make sure that both federally and at the state level you're aware of what their electronic record-keeping requirements are, whether it be encryption or security or a level of access, to make sure that you're not only running afoul of any employment laws, but any data security laws that you may have in your state or jurisdiction.
So I know I'm never going to be able to give this topic enough space, considering we only have an hour. And we generally could probably talk about this one topic for well over an hour segment. But let's talk about equal pay audits really quick. So when we're doing a wage and hour audit, are there elements that we should be considering in determining whether or not we have any exposure for any claims of an unequal pay?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you really want to take a look. And as with everything we've talked about today, job descriptions can be really crucial. It's one of the first things we generally recommend when we're working with clients, if they don't have them already, or even if they do, to review them for accuracy and make sure they're up to date. Because so many states are enacting equal pay laws where when people are doing comparable work, they need to be paid comparable, with some exceptions for different allowable variances. But as you're going through your wage and hour audit, if you start to see, whether it's gender-based or other protected classes, that there seem to be some discrepancies there, you definitely want to take a deeper dive and perhaps even consult with legal counsel in terms of a best course of action moving forward.
I think this is specifically difficult with tight labor markets, mm-hmm. where we have situations in which it's a tighter labor market. In order to attract and retain individuals, we have to pay a higher wage. And just based off of the timing of when somebody enters our organization may result in them being paid a higher amount. That's okay, right?
I haven't seen that in any of the state laws that have been passed just yet. I wish.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. I mean, that's not going to be an appropriate response to any Department of Labor audit or to any equal pay lawsuit generally. So it's important, as Paul said, that we really get on top of this and make sure that it is a part of any individual's organization's wage and hour audit. And if you do start to see that there are problems, I mean, Paul mentioned it, but it might be something that you need to get counsel involved on, purely so that you can have privileged communications about how you're going to respond to this information.
Yeah, that's really where the employer and counsel relationship really is important.
I'm Tani Alvarez, and this is HR Power Hour, and today we're talking to Paul Corrales, Vice President of HR Services at MassPay Solutions. This is News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Guys, when you buy your clothes at DXL, you look good. But you feel like a rock star. So if you want to look and feel like a... You'll find all the brands you love, waist size 38 and up, all in one awesome store. DXL, you're looking good. Right now, Harbor Bay long sleeve tees are just $29.99 each when you buy two or more.
You're listening to HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tani Alvarez, and our guest today is Paul Corrales, Vice President of HR Services at MassPay Solutions, and we've spent this session talking about wage and hour audits and the important things that people should know when preparing for an audit, either performed by themselves or with Department of Labor. I won't say guidance, but when Department of Labor comes in so that you have an idea of what good and bad things the Department of Labor could find. We've talked already about minimum wage. We've talked about worker classification, record keeping, posting requirements, equal pay audits. I guess let's talk operationally about, like, when would I perform this audit? How would I go about doing it? Can you provide some guidance as to when it makes sense to perform an audit like this and how to go about doing it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it makes sense if you're a company that doesn't experience much change, not much fluctuation in count or business activity. You might set up a standard schedule every 6 months, every year to audit a different area of the business or a different law. But certainly if you're a growth company or a high turnover company, you want to kind of get ahead of it and stay organized. So if you anticipate, say, going over 50 employees sometime in the near future, start to make the preparations there and look at your records now. If you think you might be going for some federal contracts, there's a whole different set of rules, affirmative action plan requirements, and sometimes EEO requirements if you are a federal contractor. So if that's something you foresee doing down the road, sometimes it's best to kind of do a pre-audit, see how you're looking, so that when your foot is to the fire and you are required to be in compliance with those things, you're already there or at least halfway there. Other than that, yeah, I mean, if you're looking at a merger acquisition or there's a reorganization of the company, it's a good time, again, to sit down and take a look at the books, make sure that everything is clean going forward. But yeah, it really depends. It can be specific based on the company and their size and their makeup.
I think one of the interesting things that you mentioned is kind of a division between different operational aspects of it. And I find that that's been a big aspect that has led me to recommend some form of an audit, in part looking at changes in job functions. And we talked earlier about restructuring and that some people could be exempt 1 week and non-exempt the next week, because in week one, they're overseeing two or more individuals working over 80 hours and are appropriately classified as executive exempt. But then let's say one person leaves the organization or there's some form of restructure. Maybe that individual no longer is exempt and has new job duties and responsibilities. And that, from an operational standpoint, should lead you to be auditing and really questioning the policies and procedures, correct?
For sure, yeah. And that job description really needs to be a living, breathing document. Unfortunately, sometimes we do meet with a company and they feel they're in good shape. They've got job description in place. But when we get down and ask them further questions, we realize those haven't been updated in 5 years, 10 years, and they're really not accurate to the work that's being done by those individuals today. So that can definitely be a liability and exposure for a business.
If there are HR professionals who are listening right now who want to perform an HR audit but don't think that the rest of the organization, either their managers or operational supervisors, would get behind it, what are some reasons why it makes sense for people to perform an HR audit kind of from a wage and hour perspective as soon as possible?
I think you just have to go as far as looking at a state or federal website and looking at the code and seeing what the potential fines or penalties can be. And as you said, more often than not, it's not an isolated incident. It quickly can turn into class action or triple damages or what have you. So sometimes if you're looking to kind of get some buy-in, you might start with a spot audit. If you have your suspicions about a specific department or employee that might be out of compliance, you can just take a look at that person and use that as your test case to make the case to the executive team that there should be a more widespread or more in-depth audit to take place. So like with many things in life, sometimes you just have to trust your gut. If you feel that something might be off, it's worth taking a look at because, again, it's much better to do it internally and do it ahead of time than have to deal with the consequences or be caught with your pants down, for lack of a better term, down the road.
Paul, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Until next time.
And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Hi, I'm Ben Ford from Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group with your Tip of the Week. Depositions are formal proceedings that allow attorneys from the other side to ask questions with answers recorded and under oath and sometimes even videotaped. Because you are on the front line as an HR professional, it is very likely you will be deposed at some point in your career. So here's a few things to keep in mind. Number one, listen to your lawyer and follow their instructions carefully. You'll likely meet with that lawyer before your deposition. Number two, do not speculate. If you are asked a question that you don't know the answer to, say so. If you are asked to speculate, don't. You can refuse to answer a question that you don't know the answer to. Number three, wait until the question is fully asked, then think about your answer for a second or two, then answer. This gives your lawyer time to decide on an objection. Number four, practice answering questions with your lawyer in a role play scenario. Number five, after the deposition, you will be given an opportunity to review the transcript. Take that opportunity and correct the record when needed. Got a deposition coming up and want to run stuff by us? Call Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.